When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Tonight on The Readout.
It's a historical case, and, you know, this is going to define so many things. But at the same time, our job as a juror, right, is to be impartial, like to be unbiased.
That dismissed prospective juror said she could not be impartial about Donald Trump. But today, 12 New Yorkers, 7 men and 5 women, said they could be and have been sworn in for the Trump hush money trial. Also tonight, the Kennedy family endorses President Biden, rejecting the candidacy of one of their own, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Good evening. I'm Jason Johnson in for Joy Reid. We begin tonight with a breakthrough moment in the first criminal trial of Donald Trump. Just hours ago, New York Judge Juan Merchan declaring that, quote, we have our jury. That's right. After 3 days, 12 people, 7 men and 5 women, have been selected and sworn in to decide for the first time in American history whether a former president is guilty of a crime. An alternate has also been sworn in. 5 more are yet to be chosen. But Judge Merchan says he remains hopeful that opening statements can begin as soon as Monday. It is a major development in the hush money election interference trial. But it didn't come without some drama this morning, as 2 jurors already seated were abruptly dismissed. One was excused after questions were raised about the accuracy of some of the answers he had given the court. The other was dismissed after telling the judge she had concerns about her identity becoming public. The juror said that friends and family have already inquired about whether she's a juror. And given these outside influences, she was concerned about her ability to be fair and impartial. After excusing her, Judge Merchan instructed journalists in the room to stop reporting on prospective jurors' employers and asked them to use common sense when giving physical descriptions, all of which just goes to show one of the major challenges these jurors face in deciding the criminal fate of one of the most well-known and dangerous people in the country. As the New York Times puts it, quote, jurors are risking their safety and their privacy to sit in judgment of a former commander-in-chief who is now their fellow citizen, a heavy responsibility that could unnerve even the most seen at all of New Yorkers. And it comes, as the DA's office said this morning, that Trump has violated the judge's gag order an additional 7 times, including a post he made yesterday quoting Fox's Jesse Waters, falsely claiming that some of the prospective jurors are, quote, undercover liberal activists. Joining me now to discuss is Suzanne Craig, New York Times investigative reporter and MSNBC contributor. She was in that courtroom today. Katie Fang, trial attorney and host of The Katie Fang Show here on MSNBC, and Renato Mariotti, former federal prosecutor. Thank you all so much for joining me today. This is absolutely fantastic. I'm gonna start with this. Katie, this is just a general question that non-lawyers like me who lived through the OJ trial, it immediately occurs to me, given the concerns that we have about safety. Is there a possibility these jurors could be sequestered? Because it just seems to me that this question of keeping their identity safe and having the reporters not say, well, he had glasses and she was this color and that color and this hairstyle. It seems to me that sequestering the jury might be the safest thing. Is that a possibility in this case?
I don't think it's a possibility at this point. I mean, could Judge Merchan do it as some type of remedy because things get worse? Sure. But I think part of the complicating issue, Jason, is that when you're going through the jury selection process, when you do have the intentions of sequestering a jury, that is part of the analysis in the prospective jurors' minds as to whether or not they can commit to sit in service on a jury like this trial. And so part of what's going to be a problem is Can you really go back to square one? Can you really scratch everything? If you try to sequester this jury and then you get people that say, look, I cannot, for whatever reasons, maybe they have to care for somebody in the evenings when the court recesses, they're otherwise okay during the day, but they cannot make that commitment to be out of pocket literally for weeks. And so I think that's the biggest complicating factor that you have here. All of that being said, it doesn't mean that Judge Juan Merchan is without some type of recourse if Donald Trump continues to violate gag orders and threatens the safety and the security of these jurors once we actually have our 12 plus 6 alternates, right? And that includes everything up to confinement, incarceration, jail for Donald Trump. And I understand there's been arguments made that, oh, it's so logistically difficult because he has Secret Service, et cetera. But I've said this once before, and I'll say it again for you, Jason. There's really no other safe place than to be in a jail. You're in a cell, you've got walls, and you're not going anywhere. And so I feel like there are remedies available for the judge. Sequestering may not be one of the options at this point.
Suzanne, so you were in the courtroom today, and I want to ask about this because, you know, there's always been comments that Trump fell asleep and that Trump was having trouble paying attention, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you've been in courtrooms before. They're difficult.
Right.
They're not always fun. They're not always interesting. Just based on what we know about Donald Trump and what we've seen so far, what do you think his capacity is to hold himself to any sort of reasonable or responsible behavior through an 8-week trial? Look, I mean, he's a fidgety old man, and I don't know that he's going to be able to do this. What do you think is the likelihood of that, and how might his lawyers be anticipating the fact that he's hard to control?
Well, I think there's two things there, and I think one thing we noticed today is he was very alert and he was paying attention to the jury, but I think the variable in his alertness was that the courtroom was extremely cold today. And the other days it's been hot, and they have two speeds going on downtown in those courtrooms. It's pretty cold and it's really hot. So I think that really actually made a difference. So I think on the alertness level, he'll be awake if it's that cold. We all were. It was freezing, and it was freezing outside. I think on the other question, I think it's going to be hard for him to control himself. On Monday, we saw he was admonished by the judge for, I wouldn't say jury tampering, but he was kind of menacing with a juror. A juror was called in and asked some questions, and he was, you know, doing his hand gestures and sighing. It was audible, and the judge said, enough. And if he continues to act up, there's no fine at the end of that. The judge can actually put him in jail.
Renato, speaking of the jurors, the jurors have to give up a lot of their life. They have to put themselves in danger. There's a lot of risk. And then they have to deal with bad faith and dangerous members of the press. I want to play some sound from Jesse Waters at that other network and some of his comments about one of the jurors. Get your thoughts on the other side.
She said two things that really stuck out. One, quote, I don't really have an opinion of Trump. And, quote, no one is above the law. I'm not so sure about juror number two.
Now, look, this juror has now been excused. She's not going to be involved in the trial anymore. And I've said, like any sort of common sense person, it's very difficult to find anyone who doesn't have an opinion of Donald Trump. But I think what's important about what we just saw there is not just an absolutely terrible person masquerading as a journalist, threatening the life of somebody who's trying to do their civic duty, but we also saw what the overall concerns are that people have that, look, I'm just answering the letter that I got in the mail to do jury duty, and my whole life is being put up like a LinkedIn chat. You know, Mario, what do you think can be done other than just asking journalists to be more responsible? What can be done to keep these people safe? Because I'll be honest with you, if we've already had two people drop out, I can't imagine that we're not going to have maybe a week into this trial, someone else say, I just can't do this and leave. And that could throw the whole investigation, the whole trial into chaos.
You know, I think we saw the first step towards that today. When the attorney, the main attorney, the lead attorney for Donald Trump asked the prosecution which witnesses are going to be called the next day, the prosecution refused to reveal those witnesses because they were concerned about intimidation. And what did the judge do? He backed them up. He said, yes, I'm not going to require the prosecution to tell you which witnesses are going to be called. Why does that matter? Well, I will tell you, someone who's tried dozens and dozens of cases, that's a typical request and it's a typical courtesy given, so that this way the defense can prepare for those two or three witnesses and not have to be ready for all of the potential witnesses that could be called over a 6-week trial. What was the judge doing there? He's using his discretion and his control of the courtroom in ways that will penalize Trump more than $1,000, more than some inconsequential fine, but will actually hit him where it hurts in the trial where the judge has power. So I think Judge Merchan, both in instructing the press, as you mentioned earlier, and in controlling the courtroom, is starting to come with ways to put pressure on Trump and get him to behave.
Katie, one of the things that's been really interesting to me in the sort of jury selection is trying to find that sweet spot, right? There's absolutely nobody on this panel tonight who would ever get on a jury. they don't like lawyers. They don't like journalists. They don't like educators. These are people that most...
Oh, I don't know.
Most...
Jason, first of all, I apologize for my dog, but there are lawyers that are on this jury. So lawyers do make it. You'd be surprised.
So,
but go ahead.
So that's the thing. That's what I wanted to ask about. Like, what's the mindset behind that? Because generally speaking, in my knowledge of trust, you're afraid of people like that. If I'm a lawyer, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, if this lawyer is in agreement with my argument, then they're going to be sort of basically my paralegal in the jury room. But if they don't agree with me, this is somebody who is sophisticated enough to undermine my entire case. What's the mindset behind, the prosecution and the defense with something like having a lawyer on the jury or having an educator on the jury? What's the philosophy? What's the strategy?
Yeah. And again, I apologize. My dog is agreeing with you, Jason. So here's the thing. One of the wrinkles that happens is that because in New York, and it's unusual, because the foreperson is already determined by the very first juror who is sworn in and seated, who we already know is a gentleman. Like, because that happens, then it becomes a little bit okay to have lawyers. Why? Because normally when you actually have jurors go into a deliberation room or a jury room and they participate in the selection of the foreperson process, sometimes you're concerned if you're a lawyer and you're selecting jurors that those other jurors are going to militate towards saying, you know what, we want to make that lawyer our foreperson because they know the law. But considering the fact that some of the lawyers that have been kind of screened and filtered out through this jury selection process are corporate lawyers, they're not necessarily criminal lawyers, I think that kind of gives a little bit of ease to the people that are here. I put so much faith, Jason, in the ability for these Manhattan DA office prosecutors to make these decisions. They had limitless for-cause challenges. So if this juror could not be fair and impartial, they were gone straight out gate, right? But then they also had a certain number of peremptory strikes. And when the day proceeded and progressed today, the DA's office was left with two peremptory strikes when the defense had none left. And so it really is a little bit of a dance that you're doing in the art and the science of jury selection. But having lawyers necessarily on a jury is not a bad thing, especially when you have a case that involves documents. It's not particularly complex, though. But when you have to read a statute and you have to consider falsification of business records in the first degree, because you're trying to cover up something else, sometimes lawyers are able to break down those statutes in a way that makes it better for them to serve on a jury like this.
Suzanne Craig, Katie Fang, Renato Mariotti are staying with me because there's so much more to talk about from a big day in court. This all-star panel is back with me on the other side of the break. Stay with us. This is Jason Johnson sitting in on The Readout. Back with me are Suzanne Craig, Katie Fang, and Renato Mariotti. So I want to continue this sort of conversation we're having here about the jurors and what's to be expected of them. I'm amazed by this quote from a juror who is actually seated. One of the jurors who was seated at the very end, juror number 11, was asked earlier how she felt about Trump. She responded that she didn't have strong opinions, but added, "I don't like his persona, how he presents himself in public." She then said, "I don't like some of my coworkers, but I don't try and sabotage their work," she says, drawing an outburst of laughter from the jury box. Now, I'm amazed by that. I think that is amazing, but it sort of speaks to this idea that we're trying to find this safe space. Suzanne, you know, do you think that not only is that sort of a great quote, but do you think that's reflective of perhaps how a number of these jurors may feel, even if they weren't necessarily that eloquent, because they can't say they don't know the guy.
Right.
But they say that they can look at the situation fairly.
I think some of them, yes. I think we have some people, I'm sure, in there that don't like him, but can set aside those feelings and move forward. I sat through the Trump criminal trial, the Trump Organization criminal trial in late 2022. Donald Trump wasn't a defendant in that, so it was a little bit easier because they could say, you may hate the guy, but this is about his company. Can you set your feelings about him aside? But, you know, I do think that they're there, but I also think what we saw today, there's some that can be fair, and then we also saw some that got up and said that they could be fair, and then Donald Trump and his team, as well as the government, they have access to the names of these jurors, and they started scrubbing their social media profiles, and they found stuff that contradicted statements like, I can be fair. You know, they had tweets that were pulled up that were disparaging about the former president, and those jurors were, you know, were excused and were questioned about that. But we saw that today. So some of them maybe forgot that they'd done it. They didn't disclose it, whatever the case was. It's difficult to pick a jury. And you also are seeing coming into this, and it was jarring this morning. We had 7 jurors picked last night. We came in this morning and one of them came in and had that change of heart. And part of it was, she was worried that her family knew that she was down there, even though she hadn't identified herself. And the other fellow there was excused. There were some questions about his integrity raised. We don't know if that's why he was excused, but in leaving, he also said he had questions about the identity raised. So there's just a lot of issues, and it just goes to show how hard this is. And I wouldn't be surprised if we walked in tomorrow and maybe we lose one or two just based on what happened yesterday.
Renato, this is another part of this that I think is particularly interesting. The fear, right, the fear that everyone would have is that there's somebody who's just some diabolical genius, some Sherlock Holmes, right, who can beat a lie detector and manages to get themselves on the jury, and they have, you know, an absolute love affair with Trump in their mind, or they absolutely hate the man. How likely is it? I mean, you know, both of these sides are highly qualified lawyers, but how likely is it that you could have a mole? Heaven forbid, it's not like Jesse Waters is correct, but how likely is it that you could have someone who could get through this entire process, have scrubbed their social media, scrubbed their social media and made it absolutely incapable of knowing how they strongly feel purely for the purposes of, I guess, throwing the case for Trump or against Trump?
I think it's highly unlikely. It's much less likely than John Grisham or a movie director might have you believe. You know, what's much more likely is that, you know, people may think that they can set aside their prejudices, but always have subconscious feelings. I think realistically, the biggest thing that Trump is looking for are not a hidden mole. They'd have trouble finding that person if that person existed. I really think his lawyers are looking for people who look at the obvious and see things that are not obvious. You know, the people who think that maybe there is a flat earth or maybe we're all part of a computer simulation. You know, they're looking for people who are a little unusual and see the world differently. But I don't really think you have to be too worried about the diabolical, John Grisham-like scenario.
I mean, if you walk into the jury room wearing a MAGA hat saying birds aren't real and you're a Patriots fan, maybe they think that you're pro-Trump. Katie, I want to ask you this because, you know, one of the other elements of this is, again, we've talked about Trump's danger, some of the problems he presents, and he has already violated his gag order 7 different times. And this is a quote from the judge. And I think this is really key. Defendant is directed to refrain from making or directing others to make public statements about any prospective juror or any juror in this criminal proceeding. This is the thing. And we've talked a little bit about this, but I want to know how far this goes, right? Mm. What is the scale of consequences for Donald Trump continuing to violate the gag order? Because it doesn't seem like anybody has it in them. He's been violating gag orders like crazy, right? He's a dog chasing cars. He doesn't know what he's going to do, but he's just going to keep chasing the cars. So no one's throwing him in jail. People have penalized him. They've said it's bad. They give him a smack on the wrist and he keeps going. What could actually happen here? What's the worst that could happen to him if he continues to violate the gag order? And heaven forbid, something dangerous ends up happening.
The short answer and the immediate answer to your question is he could go to jail. He could be incarcerated. And that is allowed for under the New York laws and applicable procedures. It's a fine up to $1,000 each time, but it also can be a fine and jail or a fine or jail. Putting it into context, Jason, the other times that he violated gag orders, for example, Justice Ngoron's gag order where he got deemed $15,000 or whatever, that was in a civil fraud case. This is a criminal case. And that is why you see what Renato pointed out earlier in this hour, that the judge is not allowing the defense to get the names of these witnesses in advance because of a fear of what Donald Trump is going to do. I know a lot of people who are tuning in and watching right now are very impatient, and they don't understand why Judge Marchand hasn't done anything yet. But I want to reassure people that on Tuesday, there is a process and a procedure by which this contempt hearing has to be taking place. Under the rules and the law, you actually have to have an evidentiary hearing. It cannot just be the judge saying, I'm holding you in contempt of court. Have a nice day. You have to afford Donald Trump, and I know it sounds unfair, but it's the way the due process is. You have to afford Donald Trump the opportunity at an evidentiary hearing to be able to show cause, meaning prove or show why he should not be held in contempt of court, because that is what the prosecution is seeking in this instance. And that is what is going to happen on Tuesday. And that is why Judge Marchand today took all of those violations of the gag order and said, I'm putting them all to be heard on Tuesday morning. And that's going to be done in the morning. I would also note, Jason, another kind of component that's happening here is, you know, when our colleague Yasmin Basugian interviewed one of those excused jurors, she said, and I know we all laugh about it, she said, he looked less orange in person. Now, I beg to differ. I don't know if he looks less orange, but the reality is she's seeing a man that is forced to have to sit in court. And you take away all of the bluster and you take away all of this idea in the public, in the media about what a big guy this guy is. And he's just this old dude sitting there looking orange and tired. And what it does, though, is I think it recalibrates everybody from the judge to the lawyers to the jurors to understand he's just a guy. He is not a deity. He is not a cult leader. He is just a man who has violated the laws. And just like all of us that violate a law, there's going to be consequences. So when he violates a gag order, the judge is going to say, you know what? You're not learning your lesson, and I can put you in jail. Or I can take you out of court. I can make you sit privately somewhere else where you cannot be in the courtroom. I won't let you have access to a phone. I mean, there's remedies there, Jason, and we're going to see exactly what happens when we have that hearing on Tuesday.
I can imagine a circumstance where Trump wants to be thrown out of court because then he doesn't have to pay attention.
Sure.
Suzanne Craig, Katie Fang, Renato Mariotti, thank you so much. You guys have been a fantastic block to start us off today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
She was a contestant on The Apprentice and a Trump White House aide. Few have better insight into Trump's mindset on day three of jury selection than Omarosa Manigault Newman. She joins us next on The Readout.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Jury selection in Donald Trump's hush money trial resumed for the third day today. We've already seen a courtroom marked by fiery exchanges over old Facebook posts of prospective jurors and Trump's behavior, all of which is likely to get worse. Now that, drumroll please, 12 New Yorkers have officially been selected to decide the criminal trial in Manhattan, the first for a former American president, you may have thought that his social media screeds sound unhinged before, but they're going to get worse. We ain't seen nothing yet. Remember, Trump is required to attend every day that court is in session and to make nice. Yet prosecutors say Trump has violated the gag order imposed on him 7 times, urging the judge overseeing the trial to hold him in contempt. How exactly will this fiasco go on for 8 more weeks? Joining me now to discuss is Omarosa Manigault Newman, a former Trump White House aide and former contestant in the first season of Trump's Apprentice reality show. She's also the best-selling author of Unhinged, an insider's account of the Trump White House. Omarosa, it's great to see you this evening. It's been a couple years since we've been able to chat. I want to establish something here that I think is really important for the audience to understand. You didn't just appear on The Apprentice, but you continued to work with Donald Trump. You made other appearances on The Apprentice, and you worked in his White House. So you have a perspective as to how he behaves when he's in a position to judge people and how he may respond when he's in a position to hear judgment. So from your perspective, just overall, how do you think he's going to handle having to sit in trial every single day and listen to people talk about him?
First of all, Jason, great to see you. I will tell you that I've had to sit through long ceremonies with Donald Trump. I've had to sit next to him during long church services or different policy events. And Donald Trump cannot focus, nor can he sit still for very long. In fact, we used to build our events specifically to address his attention deficit. We would break up the event so that he could be stimulated and not fall asleep. We would slide him different information or news articles that he could read while these long proceedings were going on, anything to keep him focused so that he wouldn't just get up and walk out. I think it's going to be very difficult for Donald to sit through 8 weeks of these proceedings. Sometimes they're not exciting. Sometimes they're procedural and very boring. And as you've heard, he sometimes falls asleep during these sessions.
And Omarosa, also, I wonder about this. If he starts to hear testimony that he doesn't like or that he's frustrated by or he doesn't believe in, is there a chance that he's going to blow up or he's going to blurt out? And how would his lawyers try to handle that?
I would absolutely say it's highly likely. You know, during the campaign, one of the things we used to say is let Trump be Trump. Well, the worst place that you can allow Trump to be Trump is in a courtroom, because Donald Trump will express himself. If he hears something he doesn't like, he cannot hide it, nor can he control his expressions, his emotions, his outburst. And so I suspect that he may be held in contempt because he's not going to be able to control himself.
One of the things that I think a lot of people don't understand about you, and I would like them to understand sort of after this segment, is you have a life now that people caught up in reality TV may not see. You're in law school. You were the first lady of a church. I mean, you have a different life than what a lot of people think. So I want to ask you this as a current first lady of a church in Jacksonville who also used to work in this White House. Donald Trump is not a man who usually seeks redemption because he doesn't think he's wrong. But in a case like this, it's important to be able to present yourself, even just as the jury is watching you, as somebody who is penitent. Do you see that in him? I mean, as somebody who worked for him, as somebody who's in the church today, do you think that's something he can pull off?
Well, thank you for mentioning the church. Today is my husband's birthday, Pastor Newman. So happy birthday. But yes, I have sat through church with church services with Donald Trump. I've talked about religion with Donald Trump. Remember 2 Corinthians. He knows nothing about the Bible, but he certainly doesn't know anything about contrition. And you're absolutely right, Jason. Donald Trump has convinced himself by saying it over and over again that he's done nothing wrong in this particular case. And the evidence will speak to whether or not that's true.
So the other part about this is these trials aren't just what's going to happen to Donald Trump, but politically, as a political scientist, those who are watching the show wonder what the impact of these trials will be on individuals who formerly supported Trump. And that is an era where you have a unique area of expertise. You were somebody who used to work in a Trump White House. You left. You wrote a book. You talked about how it was absolute chaos and a mess. So as somebody who used to be a part of Team Trump, and somebody who worked on African-American outreach in particular, Do you think that any of these trials, this trial in New York, which is probably the most salacious, if they result in a conviction, do you think that has an impact on people in Trump world? And particularly, do you think African-Americans who supported Trump may be less likely to support him now if this trial results in him being found guilty?
Well, let me just take it a little further. Prior to working in the Trump White House, you know, I worked in the Clinton White House. Right. I'm now an independent. So the independents are the most important voter bloc in this election. So the question really is whether the independents will be swayed. And I have to tell you that they will, in fact, be swayed if Donald Trump is found guilty of these charges. Those are the most important folks right now that Donald Trump should be concerned about. And let's just hope for his sake that he can find a way to overcome that messaging when, in fact, he is, or if, in fact, he is found guilty.
One of the other things, and I want to make sure I end with this, because, again, I thank you so much for giving this particular kind of insight. One of the concerns that a lot of people have in this trial is these jurors being worried about their safety, these jurors being worried that, hey, if somebody finds out who I am, the MAGA people will come after me. You've seen people in Georgia. You've seen people in various parts of the country come under threat by appearing to stand up against Donald Trump. How real, as someone, again, who has left Trump world and is now an independent, how real are those concerns? And what should the city of New York or the federal government be doing to keep these people safe as they stand against the former commander in chief?
Jason, their concerns are very, very well founded. As somebody who's been on the receiving end of that vitriol from Donald Trump, as someone who's been in litigation with Donald Trump, who's gone through this process for 3 years with Donald Trump, you should be very, very concerned. Donald Trump will stop at nothing to try to intimidate, to try to scare, to try to dissuade any of these jurors. And so the court and the city of New York needs to take the extreme measures to protect their identity and to protect their safety. It is imperative because Donald will stop at nothing to stop the jurors from doing their jobs.
Omarosa Manigault Newman, First Lady of Church in Jacksonville, thank you so much for joining us tonight on The Readout.
Thanks, Jason.
As Arizona's Civil War era abortion law turns that state into Biden country, one 2020 swing state is raising alarms among Democratic organizers. Plus, another Republican crawls back to Trump after claiming a second Trump presidency will be a horror show. More on that when we come back on The Readout.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Arizona House Republicans once again blocked a move to repeal the 1864 near total abortion ban that was enacted when Lincoln was president. And I wouldn't be allowed to be here. A separate bill in the Arizona Senate has moved forward, but it will be weeks before they take it up. The 19th century law is set to go back into effect in June. The ripple effects are set to be felt for months. Yesterday, election handicapper Larry Sabato's crystal ball, also my former professor at University of Virginia, the Arizona Senate race, he now says it has moved from being a toss-up to being in favor of Democratic Representative Ruben Gallego actually taking the seat and winning against former Republican gubernatorial loser Carrie Lake. That's all because of the abortion ruling. This political earthquake will help mobilize voters in a state that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris need to win. Meanwhile, in Pennsylvania, another key state they need to win, a phalanx of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s siblings and relatives endorse Joe Biden for president.
President President Biden has been a champion for all the rights and freedoms that my father and uncle stood for. That's why nearly every single grandchild of Joe and Rose Kennedy supports Joe Biden. That's right. That's right. The Kennedy family endorses Joe Biden for president.
RFK Jr. also announced that he made it onto the ballot in Michigan, which is like me saying I've made it into the NFL draft, a state Biden and Harris must win but face challenges with the Arab American community. Alarm bells are also ringing in Georgia, where Biden faces an uphill battle in repeating his 2020 victory. Joining me now to discuss is Rena Shaw, Republican strategist and founder of Relax Strategies, and Alencia Johnson, former senior advisor to the Biden-Harris 2020 campaign and founder of 1063 West Broad. Thank you all so much for joining me this evening. Now, I'm going to start with Georgia. I was just there. I had conversations with people on the ground who say this place is not going for Joe Biden this year. There are many, 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 many issues on the ground, a lack of leadership, a lack of organization, an extremely unpopular Democratic mayor in Atlanta who's not going to be able to turn people out. This is not a state that Joe Biden has to have. This is a state that Donald Trump has to have. What do you think could be done with 8 months before an election to turn a state around that was so critical to 2020 success? I'll start with you, Alencia.
Listen, I think there are going to be a lot of surprises between now and November. While for those of us who pay attention to this every single day, it seems like it's tomorrow. But for a lot of voters that I've talked to, I was just in Florida at a conference, they're not paying attention so closely yet. And so we don't know what's going to happen. And I say that as there's opportunity and there's time for the Biden campaign to get on the ground and really talk about, particularly to Black voters, what they have done, what this administration has done. This week is Black Maternal Health Week. They can be doing a lot around maternal health, what they're doing for women's rights. We know Georgia has restrictive abortion laws. Let's use this issue. Conversations around voting rights. I know that in Georgia, there's a bit of frustration there. But this is when they can have one-on-one community conversations to turn that around and also remind the electorate of who Donald Trump is and all of these cases that he has all over the country, including in Georgia.
Rena, Joe Biden won the state by the mysterious 1,100 votes or whatever it is that Donald Trump was talking about. But it's worth pointing out, and this is in ProPublica, close to 100,000 voter registrations were challenged in Georgia, almost all by just six right-wing activists in July of last year. New Georgia voting laws make it harder to get access to the ballot. This seems like, I mean, objectively speaking, it is harder to vote in Georgia today than it was in 2020 or 2022. That seems like a ripe opportunity for Republicans to flip the state back to red, right?
And simply put, that's what Republicans wanted. They wanted to make it more challenging for certain people to be at the polls. And that's what they know they get the advantage from. It's a very dirty tactic. And this is, again, just part of the playbook that we see extended. It's nothing new. It's, again, putting into the minds of voters this question. This is how the Republican Party has always operated. Skepticism, deeper skepticism is now there, not just in the rural parts of Georgia.
Right.
It is there in these urban sort of communities of Atlanta. And I look at them and I'm thinking, how are they feeling about the issues that are lower than economy, for example? Are they going to come be pro-democracy voters? Are they going to hear my chant that says, your former president, Trump, if you voted for him, you ought to be concerned about him this time around because he wants to dismantle the system. And your fellow citizens in Georgia suffered from that. So why don't you, again, vote for democracy? But we don't know how that message is resonating. There's really not any good empirical data that could lead me to any conclusions on how Republicans can game out better turnout for Trump. So right now, it's a bit of a guessing game.
I also think it's really important that you have a large number of Republicans who have flipped the script, right?
Yeah.
They previously hated Donald Trump. Now they love the guy. I want to play some sound from that. And Lindsay, get your thoughts on the other side.
It is a horror show when he's left to his own devices. And so you may want his policies, but Trump will not deliver Trump policies. He will deliver chaos.
He knew that the claims of stolen election were false, and yet he decided he was going to try to stay in office by subverting that process. There was very grave wrongdoing here, and I think it's reasonable to say that it falls within the obstruction of a proceeding.
Our country can't be a therapy session for, you know, a troubled man like this. He is a consummate narcissist. He will always put his own interests and gratifying his own ego ahead of everything else, including the country's interest.
And now he's endorsing him. Look, Valencia, I will tell you, I have seen air dancers outside of car dealerships that are more reliable than Bill Barr. But I think it's worth mentioning that all of the Republicans who pretty much said that this guy was a danger to everything, democracy, hide your kids, hide your wife, he's the worst thing in the world, have all come back and said they support him. Is that really going to make much of a difference, or were they kind of already baked into the cake? Because they're not just reflective of these elites. This is regular people who are telling pollsters, I don't like him, but they're going to come back and vote for him. Is that changing anything, or is it really something we already assumed was going to happen in 2024?
Listen, I assume it's something that was already going to happen. There are a lot of Republicans who want to hold on to power. It was Mitch McConnell, who him and Donald Trump barely spoke when Donald Trump was president, and yet he said he's going to vote for him. Now, look, here's my frustration with the Republican Party. There are some, like Barr, like Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, the list goes on and on and on, who have been wishy-washy and now support Donald Trump. They know that the base of the Republican Party in order to win is very much a MAGA base. But the reality is there are a lot of Republicans out here who constantly question Donald Trump. And my question to them, are you then going to vote for Joe Biden? Because that is your only other option. If you are concerned about this person that you were concerned with when he was in office, and then when he was out of office, you were as well. And so it's interesting that you see folks like Barr out here endorsing the Republican ticket now. I will say, I don't think that their endorsement is persuading the Republican base, because remember, Donald Trump has gone off about them and called them rhinos and all of that. So it'll be interesting to see.
We have about 30 seconds, Rena. What percentage of Republicans do you think will jump to Joe Biden? We got 30 seconds.
I'm going to be very frank and just tell you, I don't think that many. I didn't vote in 2020 for Biden thinking I'd do it again this year.
Right.
And now I'm riding with Biden again. You know, this is the moment in which you say, what is more important to you? Is it democracy preserving certain norms here, or is it just a man? And many of these people like Barr think that they're creating some kind of permission structure for people like them. They're misguided.
Rena Shaw and Alencia Johnson, thank you so much for joining us tonight on The Readout. Coming up, as we near the 29th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, it's worth remembering and reminding ourselves of the dangers that violent right-wing extremism causes here at home. The Readout continues right after this break.
Terror in the heartland. A massive car bomb exploded outside of a large federal building in downtown Oklahoma City, shattering that building, killing children, killing federal employees, military men, and civilians. The explosion in Oklahoma's capital city came without warning around 9 Central Time this morning, stunning a wide area with a ferocious blast. It left a 20-foot crater. The large Alfred Murrah federal building crumbled, sending an untold number to their deaths.
That was 29 years ago tomorrow, April 19th of 1995, the deadliest act of right-wing domestic terrorism in modern American history. The bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City killed 168 people, 19 of them children, and injured hundreds more. It happened 2 years after another violent event turned right-wing rallying cry. The end of the standoff between the FBI agents and the Branch Davidian religious cult in Waco, Texas. 76 people died, including cult leader David Koresh. At the time, a lot of Americans were horrified to learn that the Oklahoma City bomber was an American citizen. Timothy McVeigh carried out the attack as a direct response to Waco. In fact, McVeigh had gone to Waco during the standoff and handed out anti-government literature. And the seeds planted by the events of April 19th in 1993 and 95 are very much still alive in the American far right. Take January 6th as domestic extremists from groups like the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and 3%er Militia were in the crowd that attacked the Capitol and tried to kill members of Congress. Last year, Donald Trump even held a rally in Waco near the anniversary and vowed to be retribution. The hard truth is the United States has always been replete with racial terrorism, from days of white mobs and lynchings to corrupt policing, even today. But the legacy of both Waco and Oklahoma City is that we're now in a state where domestic terrorism isn't shocking the way it was 29 years ago. We've become the kind of country where we used to criticize other countries for being, living with consistent politically derived terrorism. And that's not the sign of a healthy democracy. And that's something we should all think about when we vote this fall. That's tonight's readout. Joy returns tomorrow night.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.